Welcome to another episode of the Rev VR Podcast. I am your host, Reverend Kyle. We've been kicking out some pretty good episodes recently, some good conversations, which is good because that's what you as my audience ask me for. Give us some more good conversations. Doesn't always have to be a pitch, doesn't always have to be a product that we're talking about, but let's just have some good old-fashioned conversations about VR. And so a good buddy of mine, you know, an old school from long time ago VR, you know, back in the ancient days of 2013, 2014, it feels like it's been so long, but it hasn't. Says, hey, you know, we haven't talked in a while. Let's have a conversation. And so I'd like to introduce CEO of a company that I know a lot of you probably heard of. If you haven't heard of the company, you definitely heard of their big title, Servios, and their title, Raw Data. I'd like to welcome Mr. Nathan Burba to the show. Hello, Nathan. How are you today, sir?
Hey, Kyle. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. So I guess it would be terrible if we didn't reference the very first podcast that you and I and several other people, actually a lot of other people were involved.
Yeah.
That was back during, was that E3 2014?
Yeah, it was definitely based around an event, and there were a lot of people in town for that. Probably E3. I think, I don't know if VRLA was around back then, because it could have been a VRLA
I don't
event.
Think so, no. Not in 2014. So, yeah, I think because in 2014, if it was in L.A., it either had to have been E3 or maybe Connect. But I think Connect was a little later in the year.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a – because I think I missed the first Oculus Connect. I was actually in Japan at the time, oddly enough, at Tokyo Game Show. But, yeah, I think it was E3. And that was a while ago. It was actually two offices ago for us, back when the company was probably, like, 10 people or 8 people. And we had must be, like, 2.5 years ago or something. We had Zombies in the Holodeck going, and people were playing that.
Right.
And yeah, we just kind of were, like, just hanging out. And we said, hey, let's do a podcast. And everyone just pulled up chairs, and we had a table right there. And we just, you just started up a podcast, and it was pretty awesome.
It was great. Yeah, I never knew what was going to happen. You know, we would go and visit, and I was still kind of new, you know, to the traveling around and going and meeting people at their offices scene. And so, yeah, I show up, and here's people playing Zombies on the Holodeck, and I got a chance to try it, and everybody's, you know, having a good time. And we had so many people there, and, you know, I threw one of those, like, Zoom recorders like in H1 or something like that on a tripod and stuck it in the middle of the circle, and we all just yacked for a while. I mean, it was a great conversation. I just remember having such a good time and thinking to myself, man, if every one of my podcasts could go like this, I'd be the most successful podcaster on the planet. Yeah,
no, that's what we like to do at Servios, is just get a bunch of cool people together. You know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, that's pretty much what it's all about. And you get them together in reality, you know, no less. I mean, not too much has changed. The company has grown. We released Raw Data Early Access, working toward, the full release. GDC is coming up, and we have a big announcement to do at GDC. So that's going to be really exciting. But really the core of the company has pretty much remained the same. We want to make really, really cool, VR games. Really, at the end of the day, we want to be able to, we're at the same time, we want to make VR games. We also just want to make games, because we're a young company, young developers, and Raw Data was really kind of our first big title. And so this is our dream coming true, not only running a VR company, but a game company. And so it's just more of the same.
Yeah, you guys are in, I think you were in Culver City. Are you still in, or did you said you moved in?
We're technically in Los Angeles, right north of Culver City.
Okay.
Actually, James just walked in. Hey, James, I'm live on the air with River and Kyle.
Live on the air?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, James.
Yeah.
I'm about to go race and sprinting. I mean...
Yes. Yeah, James is going to do something. Yeah. Disregard what you just said.
Good for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, James is he's not, you know, doing anything with the top secret project that I can't mention. That's of course that's not happening.
top secret project.
Yeah. We have nothing top secret here. There's no projects going on. Please just disregard everything that I'm saying. It's been a fun ride, and it's, you know, for me, for kind of my life, it is about a lot of the fundamentals. It's about game development, building tools, recruiting people, and just having fun experimenting with new mechanics and then turning those into full products, and kind of being able to go through that entire process is tremendously fun. And, you know, it takes a while to get there. Really good games, they take, anywhere from 2 to 5 years to get made. So it's the industry is so hungry for content that people short-circuit that process a little bit. And we're trying to balance the need for content with the need to make something that is very rich and kind of, well put together over a longer period of time.
So raw data is a lot of those things. Most of those things. I mean, you guys have been pumping that out and showing it at all different things. I thought the booth that you guys had with Intel at PAX this past year was super impressive. It was amazing. I mean, I'm sitting here looking, I'm like, wow, look at that big crowd. Look at that. Look at all those screens all around there. Oh, it's raw data. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it was great. I mean, so how do you go from, you know, a little startup with an idea, a plan? You know, there's so many people out there right now that are saying, okay, so VR startups, you're not going to make it. 90% of them are going to fail. But here you guys are rocking and rolling, making things happen. Was there a point where you were like, uh-oh, this isn't going to happen, and then all of a sudden raw data happened? Or was this always the plan and everything's going according to the way you thought it would go?
No, there definitely were some twists and turns. Some I can get into, some I can't. But starting off, I would say it's about making adjustments. Starting off, there was no hardware that was shipped. We even started, we started the company before the DK1 was.
That's right.
I think before the DK1 came out, but after it was announced. Basically, you know, we started the company initially saying we're going to do software and hardware because we had to make our own hardware because it didn't exist. So if we're going to make a full motion prototype, you know, you want to make a Vive game or a room scale game back then, you're making all the hardware and you naturally have to. And, I would say what kind of won the day, at least early on, especially raising that Series A round of funding, was just our tenacity and our moxie and all of those things. And on top of that, being at the right place at the right time. James and I were up in San Francisco actively talking to venture capitalists when the Oculus acquisition news hit. So we were, basically everyone smelled blood in the water at that point, and it was reasonably easy to close a round of funding. But we wouldn't have been in that place if we were up there for 2 months, James and I living up there, pitching constantly. Tech that we had developed, with our business plan to bring both hardware and software into the market. And so when that acquisition happened, VC said, there's a lot here. There might be other potential acquisitions. Who could be the next Oculus? And they look around and we're right in their backyard already talking to some of the best VCs. So it's, I guess my point is, luck is something that you kind of set yourself up to do. I think there's a Julius Caesar quote maybe, but luck is... where preparation meets opportunity, I think is what it is.
But think about that, though. I mean, you know,
I think I'm misquoting that, but
it doesn't matter. We'll edit it in post. No, I'll just leave it in there. Somebody will correct us. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
But you guys had the balls, the gumption to say, we're going to jump on this now before anybody else does. We are going to be one of the pioneers, the first ones to, travel out onto the trail of the Wild West down into the VR world. you deserve some sort of credit for that. I mean, you have to get something for that.
Let me tell you the story, I guess, a little bit, you know, from the beginning. I was shown a head-mounted display by Palmer in, I want to say, September
now,
of
2011. Now, watch what you say, because this is going to be subpoenaed for a ZeniMax lawsuit.
Oh, naturally.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so Palmer had built his own head-mounted display completely by himself without John Carmack or ZeniMax, written all the software for it and all the hardware, and showed it to me at the Mixed Reality Lab in September 2011. There you go, ZeniMax. Take that.
That's right.
And Palmer is one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. It was really cool, but it was something that it was still very early. They had a few different things. They had something called the FOV to go, where you could look around a 3D scene kind of in VR with something that you used your iPhone. And then the prototypes that Palmer had, At that time, he wasn't hooking them up to Unity. It was more he was testing things out. He had like a video. Yeah, I think he had a video of Mirror's Edge running with kind of like stereoscopy that he had converted from probably a 3D side-by-side video or something that he had found online. And it showed me kind of one of the later head-mounted display prototypes. It was really, really cool, but I didn't think, oh, this is the next, you know, blah, 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 blah. That wasn't really my thought process. But then I was doing Microsoft Kinect research, and I also had been shown the Razer Hydra by David Crum, another researcher at the lab. Actually, here, I'll give you a fun fact. I can tell you how Palmer came up with the name Oculus.
Okay. Here we go.
Yeah. A guy named Adam was another researcher at the lab, and he was talking about his research about he kept mentioning Oculus and Oculi because he was like, well, if you look to the right Oculi, you'll see that if someone, he glances over this way, they'll have a tendency to look more in the distance. He basically was doing very hardcore research about how users perceive things through a head-mounted display. And Palmer literally just says, Oculus, that sounds like, that sounds like a pretty good name for a company. Or like, what do you think about that as a name for a company? I think he asked me that later. So just something that, literally Palmer at that point was thinking, thinking like a business person, right? How do I kind of push this forward? Very much like a Silicon Valley type of person.
And but he was had the opportunity to tell him, no, dude, no, let's call it something like, let's call it the Vive. No, that's cool.
I think I said it was a good day. I was like, yeah, it sounds pretty good. I was at that lab, and I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time to be exposed to these things. As someone who is a passionate game developer myself, but I just started learning Unity at the time, and I had just written a book on Cocos 2D, so I'd done a lot of 2D game development, and I was someone who had the opportunity to see the motion capture side of it, and then also the head-mounted display side of it. And so to me, being someone who loves sports and loves being kind of physical, like physicality, in addition to loving games, the idea of being physical inside of a video game and being able to actually walk around in a video game world and do stuff was awesome. If you put those two things together, like put the FOV to go together with the Microsoft Kinect, and you're able to, but now your body's in the game, now you're able, you have a head-mounted display to be able to look around. If you can walk around in 360 degrees and be tracked, now you're in the game. So to me, that's what it was always about. It was always about getting inside of the game, inside of the game engine, and doing video game stuff. So it was never about, I'll admit, I still to this day haven't read Snow Crash. I just got done reading Ready Player One, and it was cool. I mean, Ready Player One took me back to kind of my EverQuest days a little bit, in some ways. But it was never this, oh, VR was a big promised thing from years ago. I never saw it that way. To be honest, VR to me has always been just a much cooler way to play a video game. But it's like the next step past like a 90 hertz monitor and like a sick keyboard and mouse or something, from my standpoint. At the company here, Masters of Doom is required reading for everyone here.
Yes.
And because we kind of see ourselves as part of that lineage of first-person shooter and first-person game development, and VR as kind of a next evolution of that, more so than of anything else. So that's kind of a mindset that we have. So we're very much, even though we're a VR company, we're very game focused, and everything we do is very mechanics driven and very gamey. I saw those things put together, and I started kind of just asking around at the lab in February of 2012. you know, hey, does anyone have an interest in working on something like this? Maybe I could start up a project. You know, I asked my supervisor, I asked the people who ran the lab, they're like, oh yeah, great, you know, do your thing, whatever. Like, they're just kind of like, yeah, that sounds fine. What I realized, these researchers have been working with this sort of thing for like 10 or 20 years, and there's no stars in their eyes anymore about it. You know, it's kind of just a thing to them. And so the only people who had stars in their eyes, so to speak, were Palmer Luckey and James, James Iliff. James and Palmer and I had this kind of like, you know, in my opinion, very like kind of magical experience at the IEEE Virtual Reality Conference in 2012, where, you know, we just talked about like, hey, what if we, you know, had a project where you would, you know, put, what if we could make a simplified motion-based VR system. We can make it multi-person. It could be wireless. You could easily walk around in a virtual space. And maybe it only takes like, you know, a short amount of time to set up. We can use off-the-shelf stuff instead of like big motion capture stuff. And then Palmer gave us an idea for like an airship game, like steampunk airship game, like, because you're trying to solve the problem of how could you have two people in the same space and then they can actually do stuff in a game. It's like, well, you put them on a steampunk airship and then it kicks ass and they're flying around and stuff. and that's what turned it into Wild Skies. And so Wild Skies was an advanced game project at USC. And as part of it, we had to develop full motion VR hardware that, you know, like, so all the stuff, everything from, you know, stereoscopic rendering to body IK, networked multiplayer, you know, a backpack, like a backtop, you know, something that you'd wear, mm-hmm. a helmet with, you know, headphones and Razer Hydra and hand controllers that are tracked based on your head. And then the PlayStation Move eventually is what we settled on to actually be able to track you in space. All we had to develop all of those things and the software to have them work and then build a game on top of it. So the project was absolutely insane. And what I learned at that time was that I knew absolutely nothing about mechanical engineering. I knew very little about electrical engineering and was basically in way over my head. And we had this big, massive team, most of which wasn't very good. We were students. We didn't know how to recruit people properly, or, you know, we made mistake after mistake after mistake. And after a bunch of incredibly hard nights and kind of this 40-person team reducing really down to like four or five people, we came out the other end with, a full system with laptops on backs and, you know, head-mounted displays that we first borrowed from the Mixed Reality Lab. And then DK1s when they finally came out, and put all of these different pieces together, and you know, with a bunch of incredible work done by myself, Alex Silkin, who's now our CTO, James Iliff, and Graham Medijeski, we had two-player system where we could play, you know, Wild Skies together, and it was this just incredible, ridiculous thing. Presented it up on stage, and I think most people who saw it at that time didn't even know what they were kind of perceiving. I think we were the first people. We're the first people to introduce like multiplayer full motion virtual reality to Dublin, Ireland. I want to say like people there had never seen it before. We presented it there, and we did it in Sweden as well. And it was just like blowing the minds of these like little kids who never saw anything like this. Like never used a head mounted display. Like the first time you used to use a head mounted display. And I don't know if you can hear that in the background, by the way. Let me know. But
that's fine.
We're pretty loud. But basically, you know, people would never use the head-mounted display before. The first time you use it, you have hand tracking and back tracking, and you're there with your buddy, wireless, you know, in a video game, doing stuff together. Like, so it was just nuts, right? It was an absolutely crazy project. And after that was all done, we had our composer for the project, actually a friend of James, Jeremy Tisser, was actually showed this to both his father and his uncle. His father's an entertainment lawyer, and his uncle is he's not retired. He's actually he's one level below an admiral in the Navy. But basically, they checked out what we were doing, and they're like, wow, this is really incredible. And at that point, James and I had gotten together and realized we wanted to take the four of us and start a company. And so I won't go into the details, but we you know, put all those things, all those pieces together to start the company, but we needed to raise some money. And so it was a very exciting time. We were coming up with what's the name of the company and you know, what's our business plan? How do you write a business plan, right? Like all this just very fundamental formational things. We read there's one venture capital book, the first one we started on, I forget which one it is, but it's like the seminal venture. It's like, you know, venture capital for the something something entrepreneur. It's like, it is a very like standard name, but it's a really important book.
So you didn't just go get off the shelf Business Plan for Dummies that didn't.
Yeah, there's a website I used actually, and I think I built a business plan that was 100 pages. It was yeah, it was nuts. And actually, it's funny because the subsequent rounds we raised didn't even have business plans. Nobody wants your business plan. We didn't know that at the time. We developed, you know, a pitch deck and business plans. And, you know, I think we had developed one and pitched it to Jeremy's uncle, and then, you know, kind of went back and redeveloped it and pitched it to him again. And at a certain point, they were like, look, you know, you guys, you know, you're on to something. We're going to invest seed capital. And so we ended up raising a total of, I think, $275,000 in seed capital. And at that point, we were off to the races, and we got a small office, and we started, you know, recruiting a few people and developing a new prototype of the hardware, started developing Zombies on the Holodeck as kind of like game number two, more of a single player game that you could play that was a little more stripped down. Mm-hmm. I would spend all day, developing that kind of hardware, like smaller backpack that was more contained, it was more powerful, didn't have heat issues and all those kinds of things. And almost set our office on fire, actually. like 3 years ago, because I accidentally screwed the wrong size boring screw into a anchor 20 amp battery that it punctured one of the lithium ion
cell.
And the thing just starts. I hear this like wind up sound. Mm-hmm. This like sound kind of like starts like, you know, kind of getting higher pitched. I don't know what it was, and then I hear this puff, and like a smoke machine, this thing that starts pouring out smoke, and it starts to catch the table on fire that I'm at, because we had this like makeshift like wood weird table we had in the back of the office. We had to evacuate the office, then we came back and used like our bagel tongs to like pick the thing up. James picked the thing up and brought it outside and like threw it outside. It was a ridiculous thing. We had to close the office for like a week so we could like, you know, defume it, because these fumes were like toxic. It's a whole thing.
So that battery ended up being the basis for the Galaxy Note 7 design.
Well, the similar problems, right? I mean, you have these lithium ion batteries are, they are potentially dangerous for sure. Those batteries were critical. We used two of them for an hour's worth of gameplay on a chip that's similar to a chip that you'd find in like a laptop or something. Mobile VR is very hard. Actual mobile games where you're running at 90 frames per second or even 60 frames per second, and you're going through the world and you're processing a lot of information. They're just, you know, regardless of what anyone tells you, it's a very fundamentally difficult thing to do unless you have a giant battery strapped to you, because you're just going to use a lot of power. There's no way to solve that problem. There's really no technological solutions on the horizon that are really going to solve that. So in my opinion, you're better off with a beefy GPU or something designed for it that can suck up as much power as it wants than you beam it to you wirelessly or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering, you know, this is just a fantastic, you know, like an origin story. You know, it's like you're Wolverine. This is your origin story. But I think a non-informed, you know, somebody who doesn't know you and doesn't know all the history would say to themselves, well, geez, how come you and James didn't just go and help form Oculus with Palmer? I mean, you were obviously there at the beginning. Why not be part of that thing? Why go off mm-hmm. and do your own thing?
You know, we weren't that close to Palmer. I mean, Palmer was a colleague of mine, and he'd introduced us to this new technology. But Palmer had his own – I think the most important thing to him at that time was to work with John Carmack, who he was, you know, going back and forth on Mod Retro with. He had a laser focus on that. And, you know, I think if I would have articulated my worth to him specifically and said, hey, I'm a software engineer, you know, maybe I can do XYZ, that would have kind of worked out that way. But I think you know, in retrospect, I think it was the right move. I think James and I wanted to do our own thing, and I don't think if we would have pried, we probably could have joined him in doing that. But our prerogative at that time was advanced games. Advanced games, you know, at that time was more important than Palmer, was more important than head-mounted displays. All I wanted to do in April of 2012 was get my project accepted into the advanced games track, so that I had a kind of crucible or a system, if you will, to, you know, a kind of structure to bring on people and start a project. And, you know, I'd never led a project like that before. I wanted to feel what it was like to be part of a proper video game production. So that took precedence over, you know, starting a company, and then being part of like a hardware product as well. I was, you know, not entirely a hardware guy. You know, I'm more of a game guy. And getting to that experience has always been more important to me than building a widget, so to speak. You know, that was something I could enjoy. But yeah. So I think there was a difference in what our fundamental intentions were.
So if you look now, you know, and we're talking about, you know, 2012, the DK1 came out. I think I got mine somewhere in the middle of 2013. So I know some people had it before me. During that time, end of 2012, beginning of 2013, if I told you that the state of the VR industry in the beginning of 2017 would be what we have now, do you think that would have been surprising to you or expected? Or, you know, are things going according to plan for what you saw?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that early, I probably would have thought there was a more established full motion VR platform, or that element of it was a little bit stronger. I think it's a very good question, by the way. I think the realities of launching a new software platform have hit different companies in different ways. And the only one, in my opinion, who has the kind of incredible strength to shrug off any problems is Valve. Part of it's because of some of their decisions. But I think, you know, the use of the old PS Move hardware for Sony shows that they're dipping their toe in, but they're not 100% sure. Oculus, I think, has a great solution, and I think especially if they get the third camera kind of full room stuff, yeah, I think their product is really good. Could be a little wider field of view, but I think their controllers are great, and their setup is really, I mean, it's so easy. So I think their product is really good, but their you know, their platform, in my opinion, still needs a little bit of work. Well, these things don't come out of nowhere. You know, Valve's been developing their software platform for like 20 years. Right. It's very deep and robust at this point. And I think the difficulty in launching a full consumer platform with all the bells and whistles that has a lot of buy-in from people that they want to come back to all the time for a product that they're, you know, not even sure if they're going to use all the time is a very, very, very hard thing. You know, it's one thing to get people who are consistently using Steam to maybe throw in a thing every now and then, but if someone to use a new piece of software and a new piece of hardware, you know, it is just, it's asking a lot. And so I would say because the way we developed things at Servios, we were like, okay, full motion, this is going to kick ass. We're going to really push this active VR philosophy forward. And when we're doing hardware, we're going to build towards selling a hardware product and kind of integrate all of these things. And I would say I would have thought at this point some of the other players would have taken it and run with it a little bit faster. I think Valve has done a good job setting things up, and basically their customers are a good solid starting point for the VR revolution, in my opinion, because they're early adoption friendly. They've already shelled out a lot of money for a high end computer. Everything seems to kind of make sense there. So I think from that standpoint, it's going. They've kind of done what I've expected in terms of moving in the right direction. Kind of wish they had a joystick instead of a touchpad, but other than that, I think they've moved in the right direction. And then I think some of the other companies have surprised me with their a few of their decisions, I guess. And then the fact that you have Nintendo and Microsoft, and you know, a few of the others kind of lagging behind a little bit and kind of with a wait and see attitude has actually surprised me a little bit. But then again, I'm the gung ho person who started a VR startup, and you know, you kind of have to be half crazy to be a CEO of a startup company. So, I think that kind of makes sense that I would be a little surprised.
Yeah. That question, you know, it is a good question. It was raised to me numerous times over the course of the last couple months. And, you know, I found myself not being able to really answer it legitimately and saying, okay, well, I expected a guy came up to me. We had the Seattle monthly VR meetup was last night. It was art themed, so we had like people doing Tilt Brush and Medium and that Van Gogh thing and all sorts of stuff. It was really cool. But I had this great conversation. The guy's like, you know, so what did you think? Did you think that it was going to be somewhere else back then? Now? I mean, what was your prediction? And I said, well, if you really want a fun afternoon, go back and listen to the end of the year episode that I did for 2013, then for 2014, then for 2015, then for 2016. And you hear this like level of enthusiasm in my voice slowly taper off year after year after year. And what it is it's me coming out of the bubble, you know, taking myself out of this bubble of enthusiasm where, you know, VR can do no wrong and everything's going to be wonderful and everybody smells like daisies. And then hard reality hits. It's like, okay, well, like you said, we need these big companies to go and run with it. We need people to be all in. We need, you know, we need Valve to keep doing what they're doing, but maybe skew a little this way. And we need Oculus to keep doing what they're doing, but skew a little this way. And, you know, there's all these things that we thought were going to happen, and they still might, but they're taking their time.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it takes a little while. And game development today is very complex. It's arguably much more complex than it used to be, and it was pretty damn complex 20 years ago. So when you had the Nintendo 64 come out, that was something that had a lot of power put behind it. And it was, the N64 didn't come out until Mario was ready. And Mario, I don't know how long it took, 3 years, maybe more. People had Silicon Graphics workstations, third parties had Silicon Graphics workstations two and a half years before customers can get them. And, today it's very different. There aren't any developer kits for these things, or there kind of are. Oculus kind of did it a little bit, but not really, not like it used to be. It used to be you'd hold it back for a long time before everything is ready, and then you would just hit the customer over the head with it, like really, really, really hard when the whole thing came out. And that's just not the way it is anymore. So you have more of this slow rise, you know, to a viable product. Which can be a lot scarier, and then especially if the hype machine gets way ahead of that, it can be rough. I mean, there still is no Mario 64 for VR. You know, there's not something. I mean, this is right. one of the things I've kind of realized recently is that Valve has a button in their office, like a big red button, that if they want to press it, it's the Make VR a Viable Industry button. And it's right there if they want it. And all they have to do is announce Half-Life 3 for the Vive, and it's done.
There it is. Confirmed.
There it is.
Yep.
Right. So now I'm not saying they're going to do that, but they can do that.
They could.
And so they know that. And so what that does to them is they're very secure in their position. They can, you know, let it grow at the pace they need to. They can foster development. They can make sure the software and the hardware is there. Maybe make multiple revisions to make sure it's solid, because if push comes to shove, they can hit the big red button. So to me, what that says to the entire market is everyone should relax, that VR is going to be here. It's going to be awesome. Valve has your back and is supporting everyone. They believe in this. They're in this for the long haul. And I think everyone can take solace in that. And, you know, it's like keep calm and develop on, right?
I'm getting that on a shirt.
That kind of gives me some, allows me to, especially as the CEO and wondering about the future of the industry, I can relax a little bit and kind of push some of those things forward. That being said, I think it's important to not forget about regular video games. I think regardless of how cool VR is, I think people are going to play regular video games more. You know, I think that's just the nature of these kinds of things. People still watch TV. People still watch movies. People still play video games. People still do a lot of things. People still read books. People do everything. And so there's still very much that market there that people should be watching. And until VR allows you to have really big productions, people should be splitting their time working on some regular games or sharing their tools and tech with normal games that they're developing. They should be, you know, taking some of the stuff they're developing for a VR game and using it in a first-person game that they're making. Like, I wouldn't go all in on VR to the point where your company succeeds or fails 9 months from now if the industry is you know, too big or too small. Like, you don't want to have that uncertainty. So I think just being smart about some of those things is what people should be thinking about right now, but I don't think VR is going anywhere.
Yeah, there was recently a big hullabaloo about a VR development studio. They made a game. It didn't, you know, they were selling it for $20 a pop, and they can't pay their bills, and they have to go under. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you say to other startups that are in the VR space and failing right now? What is your advice?
I mean, you have to sell to the market that's available right now. And it's tough because everyone is racing, you know, there's a bit of a race to the bottom in some respects. There's a lot of product out there and a lot of it's shovelware. And so, you know, the shovelware has to be cleared at a certain point for the real products to come through. And you don't want to be part of that race to that shovelware. So you're going to, I mean, any startup in VR today is going to have to start pretty small, have to make something that's very core and kind of build a product that has a an audience that will continually come back to it, a very sticky product. You know, I have to force myself to not play Rocket League. You know, like
yeah.
it's something that people need to force themselves not to play. And I think start there and release early, and continually evolve that product. I think that's for a VR startup, that's the formula for success today. It's hard to raise more than a few million dollars for a VR software or game startup. I think also going multi-platform is very good too.
Yeah.
It's some of those fundamentals of building a small product and growing it and believing in it too. I mean, at the end of the day, build the thing that you want to see in the world. Make sure it's, you know, something that's very organic and something that you yourself want to be part of and that you yourself find, you know, interesting and useful, that you want to consistently come back to. And if you can't find that, then even if the VR industry is fascinating and new and has the potential to make you a lot of money or to make new money or what have you, if you can't find something that you get excited about that you actually want to do consistently, then it's not for you. Regardless.
Yeah. There are several developer indie devs that I've talked to. You mentioned shovelware. I actually just released a blog about shovelware and saying it's kind of okay because it's not shovelware right now because we have this deficit of content. So it's not like there's 13 different iterations of Flappy Birds for VR. That doesn't exist. It's not there yet.
Well,
but there's a lot of people that are sitting on, and this is where I totally agree with you on release it early and then hone it. There's a lot of developers that are sitting on some decent stuff, but because it's not perfect yet, they're not releasing it.
The nature of video games. I mean, you need to polish. The other side of the coin is it's a craft, you know, and you have to polish off kind of like all the rough edges before a kind of a proper release can happen. It's a weird dichotomy. I mean, that kind of Steam comes up with or has there, but yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of content, to be honest. Like there's a ton compared to what people normally expect with product releases in the past. I think people need to readjust some of their expectations. You have thousands and thousands of games on Steam and lots of VR games. People only have a certain amount of money, and it's very hard to get noticed as a new application. And so that's why you have to kind of start small and see if something sticks and something people are interested in and want to keep tabs on, and then you can start growing it. But if it doesn't stick, you have to go try something else. And I think the worst thing is when you have something that you are polishing all the rough edges on and you're taking your time with, and it turns out it's something nobody wants or something that no one can find, you know, the marketing side of it. I guess this is probably the big takeaway, you know, I think a lot of people can take, is that it doesn't matter if your game's good. If nobody can find it, no one's going to play it. Your game has to have a great customer promise and a kind of a marketing promise. It has to have a name that people can recognize somewhat easily and come back to. It has to have good SEO. It has to have a high concept that gets in their head and they can't forget it. You know, it can't, if a game doesn't have all of those things, even if it's a brilliant game, if it still won't succeed. And this is something that, like, you know, movie studios understand and the big game developers understand. You have to get all of those pieces right for something to succeed kind of in the market.
Well, absolutely. And I think what happens, you know, and I think you kind of hit on it, is we're a little spoiled We expect, when we say there's not enough content, that's not what people really mean. What they really mean is there's not enough big, huge, 40-plus hour, $69.99 games out there. Where's the AAA titles? That's what they're talking about when they say there's not enough content.
There's
a million games under $10 that you could be playing right now. But like you said, a lot of them are going to get lost in the shuffle. You know, who wants to do this? Who wants to do that game? It's not going to appeal to everybody. But, you know, that's kind of how we started off with the apps in mobile. I mean, you know, there was like 15,000 apps the first year. And the next year there was like 15 million. So, you know, you're going to have that type of level of, you know, then it becomes shovelware.
Well, but, I think also I will just add to your point there. I think we're definitely spoiled with games. I mean, you know, it used to be that like a lot of the games that we've seen come out, you know, the multiplayer, persistent games with crafting systems and unique fun mechanics. And, you know, if a game came out with a lot of the stuff that we expect today from a normal game, like 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, it was like a revelation, you know. It was like a miracle that a game would come out with such incredible features. And now it's like commonplace. I've been playing Conan Exile a little bit at work with you know, some of the guys at work, and it's kind of like it's a fun game, but it's even, I don't know, I don't want to dump all over it. It's a fine game, but it's like it's still very early, and it doesn't have a lot of the features that other games in that genre, like Reign of Kings, kind of already have, because it's still not very polished. But it's still this incredible piece of engineering that only a short time ago would be like absolutely unheard of in a lot of ways. And so I think you're right, kind of keying in on the fact that we're a bit spoiled. You know, when you get something like a Half-Life 2 or a Left 4 Dead, like those are masterpieces. You know, they're incredible. Art and engineering and design built into a product that very, very few companies can actually really properly pull off. And when there isn't something like that, you know, we have some kind of, a few titles have elements of that, I think Raw Data included, but nothing is of that quality level. That's what people are saying, is there's nothing like that that's out that they really can sink their teeth into as a core title for these platforms.
So you guys have had huge success with Raw Data. I have heard people argue about some of the numbers, and you're the best person to put this to bed. You know, is it true that you guys are doing what was it, a million a month?
Oh, no, that was for the first month.
The first month. Okay. So you did a million units or $1 million?
It's $1 million of revenue in the first month.
Okay. So prior to that, were you doing, because I think what people do is they hear that and then they think that you're continuously hitting that million mark.
Hey,
every
if they
month.
Think that, man, no, that's their business.
You know, set us straight. What is a more realistic you know, measurement of your success?
Well, to be honest, you just go on Steam Spy. I mean, all the data is public. So, let's see here. Steam Spy, Raw Data. And I cannot spell. Let's see. So you got, it's about 70,000 units at $40 a pop. Let's say that's 35 because there's sales that go on. Mm-hmm. So 35 times 70,000 is $2.5 million.
There you go.
So, yeah, so it's you know, some simple back of the napkin math.
But yet it's so difficult for people to understand, because the way that the news is reported is, well, you're doing a million every month.
I can tell you about that story, actually. So that story was, you know, you're always trying to give something punchy to the press, right? We want to be in the news so we can get people to, you know, to buy our products. And so I think I forget. It was Fast Company, I think, I was talking to. And, I wanted to give them, you know, it was me, actually. I wanted to give them a line that they could kind of run with a little bit, not give it just like a boring kind of typical story. Yeah. And so it was like, yeah, we sold a million in a month. And they ran with it, and the story just got syndicated kind of everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Ended up being a big story. And it's tough because you never want to – you know, once, like, when you're the little guy, everyone's rooting for you. And once you're, when you're the big guy, everyone hates you. And you don't want to portray yourselves as being like the evil empire or something like that. And Raw Data had a great first month. But I would say after that, it's selling like a normal, solid, successful VR title. And it's doing that because, I mean, there's still not an incredible amount of units out there. And then also, just by my own admission, there's updates to Raw Data that I would say need to come faster. Raw Data is not engineered as well as we would like it to be because it's literally our first game. It's our first Unreal Engine game. And so the stuff that we have that comes out later, other titles specifically, are going to have faster update cycles. Don't hold me this too hard, but basically they're going to be engineered more efficiently. So, you know, making a level will be 3 or 4 times as efficient as it is in Raw Data, because we didn't know what kind of stuff we were getting into at first, and we were still developing our tools. You got to remember, we're still basically a few punk kids from college who are figuring this stuff out. We're not like, you know, 20-year studio veterans,
right,
or Naughty Dog or Insomniac or any these kinds of companies. We're literally like, our central tools in tech, or that's what they used to call it at Activision, like, we're still building that out. Whereas when you have Rockstar, they're like, you know, or Naughty Dog's a great example. When they're making The Last of Us, they're taking the incredible game that they already made, which is Uncharted, and the tools that they made to have that incredibly polished experience, tools that they've been iterating on for 10 years or whatever it is, and they're saying, okay, let's try to make a new game out of this that doesn't deviate too far from what the basic gameplay of that other game was, because the tools are designed for the gameplay. And so they're able to make something of an incredible quality very, very efficiently. Whereas this is our first foray into this, and on top of that, it's in VR, and it's using UE4, which basically just came out, which is not our own custom engine. It's something that we work collaboratively with Epic on and a million other people, right? So there's all these kinds of constraints. To make something that's nice and simple and efficient is difficult at first, and then you work on it, and you become more efficient. So this is what I'm talking about with developers needing to take their time. A really solid game developer, like company, has been building its own tools and technology for at least a few years. So don't grow your company too fast trying to capitalize on the market and run out of money and fail, because you might not have given yourself enough incubation time just as a game developer who can rely on its own tools.
Yeah. See, that's where I have the benefit of, you know, I know you guys, you know, I know some of these startups. And so when I hear you know, other people hear the success of Servios and they picture like a Rockstar type of situation where there's like all these veteran developers and they're like, oh, cheers. Yes. Oh, good job. You know, I'm picturing you guys are just like screaming, woo-hoo, you know, cracking some beers and having a good time. But that's because I know you guys. You know, I know how hard you worked for this and how much you really deserve the success, but not everybody knows that. And so, you know, people get development companies get bad raps, I think, sometimes. You know, people are like, oh, you know, they're asking $69 for their game. That's so much money. They should be able to sell it cheaper. Well, no, not really. Not when 4 or 5 years of blood, sweat, and tears from a huge group of people went into it. Yeah, it needs to probably be even more than $69, but they realize that they have to actually sell a copy.
Well, also, I think it's important to note when you're talking about the gaming customers, these are people who send their feedback through internet forums, right? So it paints a picture of gaming customers as being harder to deal with than other customers, but to me, that's the medium that they're sending their feedback through paints them in that light. It was the Greater Internet Jerkwad Theory or something, the Penny Arcade Strip, right? Yes. It's that, basically. Like, these are all very nice people who I'm sure in real life would be very complimentary, even if they don't buy your game. But it's the internet, you know. So right. That kind of that kind of changes the kind of the lens through which that feedback is kind of looked at.
Yeah, there's bold, there's italics, but there's nothing to indicate sarcasm either. So that's
It's a lack of tools.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, you've been to GDC numerous years. What do you think this year? I mean, is there going to be anything special this year? Do you think that we should be looking for? I'm skipping it this year. For one thing, I'm way too busy with work and home and podcasting and stuff. But I'm totally skipping it this year. What am I going to miss? What do you think is going to be the big thing here?
I honestly don't know. I hate to say I'm the least informed CEO out there, but I'm so head down with the stuff that we're doing that I honestly don't know enough about what's dropping in terms of things like announcements. And I didn't even, if I did know, it'd probably be inside information. So I really shouldn't say anyway.
Well, you can go ahead. You can go ahead and say that stuff. I won't tell anybody. I promise.
Well, GDC is really about kind of the developer facing initiatives. I don't know. I'll be honest. I have no idea. I can tell. I can't tell you what we're doing because I would spoil the surprise. And beyond us, I basically have no information. See, as the CEO, I'm kind of a figurehead. I just have like people. What is it? Was that Parks and Rec episode where they sit the guy in front of the teleprompter and he just like sits there smiling, staring at the wall until like right. until the camera turns on and they just starts talking. Like that's basically me. I people tell me things and I have to manage. The company's large enough at this point where I have to manage a lot of that information flow to myself. Otherwise, I'll go nuts.
Yeah.
So I actually am not as up on what a lot of the announcements are that are coming up. And also, from my standpoint, I just get fatigued from kind of going over those things too much because I'm living inside such a ridiculous kind of bubble of information myself here. So I apologize for not.
It kind of proves the point though that everybody's there specifically for their thing, and then the people who attend are they're either spectators or they're the other people presenting. So I skipping GDC this year, I'm not too heartbroken about it because for one thing, there's going to be fantastic news reporting and articles galore and all sorts of streams and everything that I can watch, but I don't know. I just don't feel like there's anything that's going to be so phenomenal that I'm just jaw dropping that I'm going to miss, that I'm going to go, oh, I'm going to forever in the rest of my life regret going to GDC this year.
I hate to say it this way, but I don't think. Okay, so video games for a long time were a constant, steady kind of state of graphics technology innovation, really from I would say Atari to NES, but really Atari onward.
Mm-hmm.
You had this like, oh my God, did you see this? Oh my God, did you see this? Oh my God, did you see this? Over and over and over and over again.
Right.
And 3D rendering has gotten to a point where it's very hard to wow anyone anymore purely with graphics. And you take that away as a variable, and there's not really anything that you're going to miss out on seeing, especially in the age of the internet where you can just pull up anything instantly as well. That has an effect as well. I remember when the first time I saw Super Mario World, I thought I was like hallucinating. It was like an incredible spiritual experience, for like 6 year old. And it's not, video games are not like that anymore. We have nothing, there's no images that are going to melt your face like there used to be.
Right.
And even if Half-Life 3 for the Vive is confirmed tomorrow and comes out and whatnot, it's still not face melting, like it used to be. So I think everyone's expectations have to change, and kind of how we relate to a lot of just how the industry works has to change. It used to be I always wanted to go to E3. It was kind of like Mecca, it was like where you needed to go for like as a gamer and a game
developer. Right, yeah.
Now for me, I kind of am the same way. I'm like, everyone will do their thing and I'll just like quietly have a cup of tea in my office or something. Like I'm just like exhausted, so kind of at the end of the day. To me, it's all about it's really networking. And then it's parties, which are basically networking as well. So it's to me, it's all about people and just meeting up with other people in the industry. And then E3 is probably a little bit more of the consumer facing show, but I don't look at it from a consumer's perspective as much, just because I'm so focused on building the company and networking and recruiting and all of those kinds of things.
I think it's because it's so important for the networking. I agree with you. I think that's like the big thing for me is the networking and the parties. And when I go to GDC, there's obviously you have the ability to do that sort of thing, but it's when you go to things like SVVR, VRLA, where it's a little bit closer to home. It's a little bit more of an intimate only VR group.
Mm-hmm.
Then the networking and the parties become a lot more relevant to my interests, and I'm really looking forward to SVVR this year. Still kind of on the fence for VRLA, but SVVR is I would have to be completely broke and homeless and like living in squalor on the streets of Seattle to skip an SVVR at any year.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, right now from our standpoint, we definitely target, you know, I would say it's E3 and then GDC and then VRLA kind of in that order mm-hmm. are our three big shows. And it's two of them in our backyard, so it's easy.
Right. That makes sense.
And then GDC is just really the big industry show.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you're definitely looking at it from a different perspective than I am. You've got.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, your sure. priorities are definitely different than mine. You know, one of the things that when I. After I do a podcast and I go back and I don't do a whole lot of editing because I like it to be kind of just a natural conversation. But one of the things I struggle with is finding a clever title for each episode. And, you know, we really didn't focus on anything except we kind of mentioned Half-Life 3 multiple times. So I might just call this one Half-Life 3 Confirmed with Nathan Burbo. How about that? Or
no, that's good.
By
I like
Nathan Burbo.
Yeah, that's good. I have confirmed it. Yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have to go with that. We'll have to go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about? I know this is you know, meandering a little bit, but it's nice.
No, it's great. It's great. And that's what, you know, I know my audience loves that. You know, I like those kind of podcasts. You said you do too. You know, my audience loves to just hear passionate people talk about VR, talk about the state of the industry. If I had the ability to, I could just hit record and just talk until my voice gives out. And I feel like you'd probably be pretty good at that too.
Yep.
You know, so other than like, you know, announcing Raw Data 2, The Revenge of the Robots, or let's see, what else could you do? Zombies on the Holodeck, released for Gear VR. actually, you know what? I'm curious. Is there any remote possibility of seeing?
That's not a bad idea, actually.
Yeah, Zombies on the Holodeck. Because I had a lot of fun playing that thing.
I'll say Zombies on the Holodeck was developed for a i7 laptop chip, basically. So the onboard graphics of an Intel like HD 4000, I want to say.
Oh wow!
You can look this stuff up online, but if the Galaxy Note or whatever the latest Samsung phone is that powers the Gear VR is you know, equivalent to that from a rendering standpoint. Granted, Zombies is a motion game, but and Zombies is we tried resurrecting Zombies, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I love saying that. And it was incredibly difficult because it's like locked away in like Unity 3 or something. Ooh. Or Unity 4. Like it's not, you know, the Zombies ain't coming back because of that. And it's funny, we like, I think we played it at one point. And it's like, wow, this is so dated. So I don't know if it's something that we would be able to bring back, but I know a lot of those ideas, a lot of those concepts. Once again, high concept. You know, high concept will carry the day. Zombies on the Holodeck. It has a catchy name. The concept of black and white zombies. You know, kind of in the 40s Chicago. Like
yeah.
That's all James. You know, with great production value and stuff. Like it was a lot really fun project from like kind of like creatively and aesthetically because of that. So I would say at some point in our future, there will be something like that. Definitely, if there were a larger you know, if there's a larger kind of domestic VR market, the Vive specifically, millions and millions of people, I think we definitely could do a zombies type of game. But right now our titles have to be kind of broader. It's like making more like a PG-13 movie or something because, you know,
right.
It'll play in theaters, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But yeah, we would definitely love to resurrect Zombies as an IP. And there's a lot of cool stuff to do for sure. Yeah, unfortunately, I can't mention anything about that. But with the titles that we want to release, we want to make sure that we can release things that people can play consistently into the future so that they have great pipelines for making updates and they have multiplayer and, you know, new features coming out for them. And really our games are, each one is like a service, you know, it's something that you want to buy into and you want to get into more and more and more over time. So it's, we really don't like the, oh, this is a VR experience, you know, it's 15 minutes long and then this thing happens. Like it's, that kind of defeats the purpose. You know, to us, they're games and they're like services. They're much more like, you know, Left 4 Dead, something you play with your buddies every week and screw around with each other, or they're like Rocket League where you're playing every night and it's highly competitive, or, you know, those
right.
games we really took a lot of inspiration from Payday 2 and from Orcs Must Die 2 as well. You know, those, like, we played so much Payday. It was ridiculous. It's just so fun. And like those types of games, I think, are what we like to see in VR and what we like to produce. So they inevitably take more time and more effort. But at the end of the day, we have something that we're really proud of and that people can enjoy a lot more, in our opinion.
Yeah, that's totally awesome. And, you know, and I really respect the fact that you guys have, you know, first of all, just been tremendously successful at reading people's minds and saying, okay, this is going to be the game that other people are going to play. I mean, everything that you've ever produced, I've played and have loved. So that says something. And I think other people would totally agree with me. I think when I post this, podcast episode, I'll have to go dig up my YouTube. I have a YouTube video of me playing at your original location, Zombies on the Holodeck.
Yeah, I remember that video.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find that. I'll post that so that way people can see how far you've come, because I just remember coming out that day. That was like going and hanging out with you guys was better than that day at E3, I think. You know.
Well, that axe, that like fire axe, like smashing a zombie's like skull with that thing.
Yes.
Still feels like, you know, pretty damn good. That is a very, very squishy, you know. Well, I'll have to make something later on that has much, much, much more violence, delicious violence, because that was pretty fun.
Absolutely. So, okay, so you guys are going to be at GDC. Do you know where you're going to be?
We'll be on the floor. I don't know exactly where our booth is, but you can definitely come check out some interesting, cool new stuff, which I can't talk about right now, at our booth at GDC. Definitely check that out. Check out the news. Check out the AMD live stream. I don't know when you'll be posting this podcast, but the AMD live stream on Tuesday at, I think it's Tuesday morning at like 10 a.m.
Yeah, that's what I was told.
Yeah, so yeah. Something will be going down with that. So please check that out. And then, yeah, just follow us online on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, we're recording this on the Friday night before. So, yeah, I was told Tuesday at around 10:30 Pacific time I'll release. So if you're listening to this as soon as I released it, then happy Tuesday.
Yeah, we'll have to – I know, yeah, we're doing the little bit of the embargo thing. I think – if you actually can send this to me – you know, when it's done, I can have our VP of marketing listen to it.
And
it's fine.
It's cool. Tuesday's a good release day, I think. You know,
Tuesday's solid.
Yeah, it's good stuff. All right. Yeah. I'll tell you what, you know, Nathan, you and James and the gang, just wonderful to hang out with. Totally absolute revolutionaries in the VR space. Keep doing what you're doing, you know, and feel free to, you know, call me up at any given time and say, hey, if you're in town, let's hang out. Let's do some VR together. And you and your team are more than welcome onto the podcast whenever you're just feeling a little randy and want to talk about VR.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think we should definitely hit you up on that more. And I'd love to have more people from Servios on the podcast to talk about all sorts of different things.
Heck yeah. No, absolute. Open invitation.
Great. Sounds great.
So I want to just a few things real quick here. If you haven't bought your tickets for SVVR yet, shame on you. You should do that. Go get tickets. Buy them now. At the very least, just get expo tickets and then come and hang out with me afterwards at all the parties. Yeah, and then also VRLA is making its way mid-April, so get I think tickets are going to start selling there soon. If not already, I think by Tuesday they should be available for purchase, so go do that. Go find the Servios guys on Twitter and all the different social medias, and go do that for me as well. I'm lonely. Come find me. Come talk to me. Twitter's huge in the VR scene, so you know, keep tweeting away, all of you wonderful Twitterers, and all of you analytics, Twitter analytics people who don't think I put hashtag VR enough on my tweets. Screw you. That's how you get on the good side, is you compliment them. They don't like me. All right. So yeah, Nathan. Fantastic. Wonderful having you on the show. Thanks for coming on. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, great being here, Kyle. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. And thank you all very much for listening. This podcast is a production of RevVR Studios. Music provided by Jesse Spillane. Comments and views expressed on the RevVR podcast are the sole opinions of Reverend Kyle or his guests. For more information, visit RevVRStudios.com.